fantastically dated, aren't they? In a rather wonderful way. Yes. And of course, the sound of that organ, it does date it, but actually it transcends the date because it's such a wonderful use of it.
The kind of main lines there with that refrain of the organ and that certain timbre that cuts sort of through, doesn't it?
Hammond just,
yeah,
sound,
it's beautiful, yeah. That Hammond sound, yeah, yeah. I think Paul McCartney rates it. He met Linda, I think, the night he first heard this. So.
Whiter Shade of Pale by Procol Harum. You are about to plunge, I think tomorrow, in fact, into the Titian project.
Indeed.
So wish you the best of luck with that, Mark.
Thank you.
And thank you for introducing us to these pieces, which clearly mean a great deal to you.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Wallinger was talking to Michael Barclay, and you can see Mark's latest work, Designs for a Ballet Inspired by Titian's Diana and Actaeon Paintings, at the National Gallery and the Royal Ballet Covent Garden this week. And that's part of the Metamorphosis Titian 2012 project. Well, next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the actress Anne Reid. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
The Olympic Games are coming back to London.
From Friday the 27th of July.
It is the one we've been waiting for.
The BBC is bringing every event.
It is now a time to shine.
From every venue.
This is pressure on now. It's a great buzz around the stadium.
To everyone in the UK.
Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, scream and shout.
The Olympic Games. Never miss a moment. With the BBC.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 2 minutes past one and time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The Cabinet Minister responsible for the Olympics, Jeremy Hunt, has played down what he called the hitch over providing security at the Games. 3,500 extra troops have been drafted in after the private firm G4S failed to recruit and train enough guards. The chairman of the Games, Lord Coe, said security had not been compromised. Labour says a proposal to cut the pay of health workers in the southwest of England is a sign of the chaos engulfing the NHS. The idea is one of the options being considered by a group of health trusts. If changes can't be negotiated, thousands of doctors and nurses could be dismissed and rehired on new contracts. A former Conservative leader in the House of Lords has described the government's proposals to turn the chamber into a mostly elected House as pretty much a dead duck. Lord Salisbury was commenting on last week's revolt by 91 Conservative MPs against the bill. The former Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ming Campbell, has warned that if Lords reform is dropped, his party won't back plans to redraw constituency boundaries. Syria has rejected claims by the United Nations that its forces used tanks and artillery in an attack on the village of Tremza last week. Opposition activists said it was a massacre of civilians, but UN observers who visited the village said the assault appeared to have targeted the homes of opposition fighters. The authorities say only two of those who died were civilians. The American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is meeting Egypt's military leaders on the second day of her visit to the country. Yesterday, she had talks with Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, of the Muslim Brotherhood. She urged him to work with the military on a transition to civilian rule. Japanese troops have been airlifting supplies to people trapped in mountainous districts cut off by floods on the southern island of Kyushu. More than 5,000 people are reported to be in urgent need of assistance and 24 are confirmed dead. The weather, a few showers are likely to develop, though these could be lighter than in recent days, and some areas will remain dry. Parts of Scotland, particularly the west, will be wet and windy. The BBC News and Weather at 4:30 past one.
And so time now for the Early Music Show with Catherine Bott.
Of David the Prophet, played by harpist Bill Taylor. Welcome to the Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today I'm celebrating the world of the Welsh harp, or at least a collection of transcribed pieces which has formed the basis of Welsh harp music for almost 400 years, the Robert ap Hugh manuscript. I'm joined by Dr. Sally Harper of Bangor University, who's an authority on Welsh music history. Welcome, Sally. First of all, tell me, who was Robert ap Hugh?
Well, Robert ap Hugh's fame is almost entirely dependent on that manuscript that was copied somewhere in the early 17th century. He was quite a well-connected gentleman. The latter part of his life was devoted to farming, where he did extremely well. His roots lie in Anglesey. He was very well connected, seems to have been born on his maternal grandmother's side into the Welsh Tudor dynasty, even. And we know a little bit about his early life. I mean, there are some lovely stories of what he got up to as a young man, when clearly as part of his education he went to North East Wales and actually appeared on a couple of occasions before the court of the Bishop of Bangor for abducting the daughter of a household with whom he was staying and also for stealing a petticoat. So quite a character, one imagines.
Oh, so he had a rich life, farming, abducting, stealing livestock, excellent, as well as playing the harp. Can you put me into sort of date context? When was he born?
He was born, we think, about 1580. Now, the putting the life together, as so often with characters like this, is very much dependent on odds and ends. But his will survives, and he died in the year 1665. It was proved shortly after his death. And there's a very interesting reference there to him leaving his best harp to his godson, and that the harp itself actually had the badge of the royal arms upon it, which substantiates a theory which one of his contemporaries made, a poet, Hugh Machner, quite early on in his life, that he actually had associations with the royal court and played for King James. And although his name doesn't appear in any of the documentation from the Tudor court itself, it is quite likely that itinerant harpists from Wales turned up there and entertained on a more informal basis. So I think there is very good evidence that he was professionally trained, he was illiterate, we also know he was a poet. Not particularly good poetry that survives, but he was also a man who travelled, like many of his contemporaries. That was the bardic tradition.
How good a harpist was he?
That's a very interesting question. He himself, around about 1615, wrote a short poem when he describes himself as a pencair, as a master musician, who had learned all the main pieces, the main genres on the harp, and therefore we can assume that he had undergone a fairly lengthy bardic training. And this was also the report of his contemporary, that he was a very good harpist. On the other hand, when we come to look at the manuscript itself, there are some unusual blunders in it, glaring errors which make one wonder, well, did he really play from this from beginning to end, as it were, and why not correct the mistakes? Were he really as competent as we would like to believe? So I think the jury remains out on that.
Well, let's help ourselves decide by hearing a little bit more music. Sally, can you tell me what this next piece is called?
The next piece that we hear is what Robert ap Hugh himself described or entitled as a vigan a droich. And erdigan is a word that's very often used just for harmony, something euphonious. And a droich was a spinning wheel. It's very commonly used for any sort of wheel in the Middle Ages, sometimes the wheel of fortune. But I think perhaps here we have something that could be perhaps a work song of some sort associated with spinning.
Thank you. The Erddigan of the Spinning Wheel from the 17th century Robert Ap Hugh manuscript, played by Bill Taylor on a 15th century Bray harp. With me down the line is Sally Harper of Bangor University. Sally, we've already heard about Robert Ap Hugh, who does seem to have had rather an interesting life. Tell me something about this manuscript itself. What drove him to transcribe all these pieces and assemble the manuscript?
One very interesting thing about Robert Ap Hugh is that he comes right at the end of a tradition. And it does seem that the music that he copied, and we have just over 30 pieces written out in this manuscript, was really on the way out. It was rapidly being replaced by other sorts of musical fashions, by repertories coming from the other side of the border. And probably there was some instinct, I think, to preserve as much as anything else a repertory that was in danger of disappearing. So that's one possibility. The other is that we have a tradition where pupils learned from masters, and notating pieces was a relatively new aspect of this Welsh bardic tradition. So the tablature that he was using was probably devised no more than some 60 years earlier, maybe even less than that. And it seems perhaps that the repertory itself had acquired a level of complication, or that there was more interest in writing things down, and that the bards themselves, so professional harpers, had devised a notation that enabled them to actually record in more detail how the music was to be performed, what it was to sound like.
So it's a basically oral tradition, teacher to pupil, teacher to pupil, and the bardic players were devising a sort of notation and tablature. Is it one that's easy to read nowadays?
It isn't easy to read, and I think one of the rather wonderful things about it is that ever since the manuscript was rediscovered, is that it has fascinated antiquarians, musicologists, performers, who have really asked all sorts of questions of the tablature and how it works. So, for instance, it found its way into the hands of Charles Burney in the 18th century. Arnold Dolmetsch spent an awful lot of time with it, made his own transcriptions in the first part of the 20th century. And since the 1990s, there's been a really wonderful upsurge of interest in it. And I think we are now getting much nearer to a more authentic understanding of what the tablature is actually trying to represent. But some of the difficulties inherent in it are that although it's easy enough to establish what pitches are being written down, or strings as a tablature notation, it's extremely compact, an awfully concise sort of notation where you get shorthand, where you have little signs saying go back to the cross or do this again in the same way but using a slightly different sort of figuration. So there are a lot of problems associated with unpacking all that and how one actually performs it.
I'm absolutely fascinated to think about this very early exercise in early music preservation. In the 17th century, when really by definition, if you were listening to a piece of music, it was contemporary music. The idea of early music didn't exist in notated music. And there's Robert Ap Hugh assembling stuff from many, many years before he was born. I find that really compelling.
I think it's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? What we're not quite sure about is how early this repertory actually is. I think there's no doubt that parts of it would still have been played in certain circles during the early 17th century when Robert Ap Hugh was alive. So it wasn't simply an exercise in writing something that was never played at that point. But there are clues within the tablature itself as to when the main body of this music was probably being conceived. And I think the late 15th century, the second part of the 15th century, is quite key. So if we look at the names of some of the harpists who are feted in the titles, for instance, certainly there are 15th century associations there. Though on the other hand, it represents this tradition of playing the harp, the professional Welsh bardic tradition, has much longer roots than that. And the tradition itself, probably this high status playing on the harp, goes back even further than that. So we're looking at something with very long roots, there's no doubt about that.
Thank you. Paul Dooley playing a piece called Proviad ob Botum from the Robert ap Hugh manuscript. Sally, there's a phrase that crops up quite a lot in reference to Welsh harp music, and it's cerdant, I hope I'm saying it right, which yes. really means string music. Is that right? Can you elaborate?
Yes, cerdant is a phrase that is absolutely key to our understanding of this repertory, really. Now, cerd literally means a craft or an art rather than simply being music. The implications there are that we're dealing with a high-status professional craft. The word dant, or from tant, means a string, so the craft of the string, essentially. And it's a word or a phrase that first crops up in the 14th century, and it's very clear that there are two main instruments associated with it in Wales, the first the harp and the second the crwth, which we'll be hearing later. I think we have to imagine this as entertainment for those who were in the know, for a quite sophisticated courtly audience. So it was the sort of music that one would hear in among the nobility, in the houses of the Welsh nobility. And professional bards would travel from house to house, sometimes really quite considerable distances, to provide music, to provide poetry for their patrons. And the other rather illuminating thing about the phrase itself, cerdant, is that it's a parallel to the poetic craft, which was called cerdavod, or the craft of the tongue. So the whole that really embraces the Welsh vernacular, medieval vernacular poetry in its own right. And again, it gives us a sense of two sister crafts that interact with one another.
And it strikes me that these two sister crafts are still celebrated today in the Eisteddfod tradition.
I suppose these days we tend to associate the Eisteddfod rather more with an element of competition. And I'm sure that was also true with the medieval Eisteddfod as well. And in fact, the earliest reference that we have to something that probably was rather like an Eisteddfod allegedly happened in 1176, when there were competitors who did compete for the bardic chair as the best musician, as the best poet, and so forth. But the other element of the Eisteddfod that was really key to professional players in Wales was that it enabled you to graduate. So by proving that you had mastered a certain number of pieces within a particular genre, proving that you were competent up to a particular level, that enabled you to win a level of apprenticeship, or even eventually to graduate to the status of a master craftsman, or to the status of an athro or a teacher, where you were qualified to teach others. So there's a real sense of hierarchy embodied within the Eisteddfod tradition that perhaps is a little less strong today.
Is there any poetry, thinking of craft of the tongue, is there any poetry in Robert ap Hugh's manuscript?
We don't actually have any poetry within the manuscript that survives itself, but there are all sorts of contemporary manuscripts from the later Middle Ages that certainly refer to music, that refer to harps. And the crucial thing, I suppose, about this late medieval poetry was that it was not the sort of literature that you read at home on your own. It was there to be performed. So that partnership between the two crafts, the craft of the tongue, poetry, and the craft of the string, playing your harp or your crwth, very clearly do go together in that sense.
Well, we're going to hear a crwth now. This piece actually unites the craft of the string and the craft of the tongue, because Mary Ann Roberts is singing while Robert Evans plays a setting from the Robert ap Hugh manuscript of Psalm 150.
Thank you.
Braggod, otherwise known as the singer Marianne Roberts and crwth player Robert Evans, with that setting of Psalm 150 from the Robert ap Hugh manuscript, which is the focus of today's early music show. Sally, let's head back to the harp-playing tradition now. I know there are various different schools of thought, shall we say, when it comes to performance practice. Can you fill us in on that?
I'm not necessarily sure that there are right or wrong answers about a number of these areas. But I think the rather lovely thing about the whole debate is that it's been going on for so long, because right back into the 16th century, when the first attempts were made to write down some sort of theoretical context for this music, the same problems arose as to how things actually worked. So one quite difficult area to work with is tuning, where the early theoretical sources refer to five standard tunings. At least we think the word is tunings. In Welsh, it's coair, or coeiriae, or settings, effectively, rather than tunings. But theory dictated that one of those five standard tunings was generally used, and there were various attempts to list them. Robert ap Hugh himself had a go at writing them out as scales in the back of the manuscript, and then there were some more on top of that as well, but they're not always recorded in the same way. Thurston Dart was somebody else who had another go at trying to decide which were the ones that were most appropriate for the repertory. A more recent school of thought, and this one is based on very, very close study of the whole repertory itself. So what we have in the tablature is that a single tuning with simply the B flattened works very, very well for most of the pieces. So I think there is an ongoing debate about that, which is quite interesting. And the other two areas, again, where one hears very different interpretations, are to do with rhythm, where each piece or most of the pieces are underpinned by a measure, what was referred to as a mesur in Welsh, which essentially was based on alternation of two groups of notes, two triadic groups of notes. And there's one school of thought that thinks that each of those are absolutely equal in value in terms of rhythm. So you get a very steady underpinning. And the figuration that the uphand plays, which elaborates over the measure, again, there are all sorts of different figurations, different ways of beautifying that pattern. And the way in which they should be interpreted is again, not entirely settled. There are various schools of thought on that.
Well, I think the various schools of thought should continue to dispute gently and amicably, possibly forever. Let's hear two recordings of the same piece now so that we can compare the different styles of interpretation. We're going to hear Paul Dooley from Ireland on his metal-strung harp playing the Canyad of the White Piper. And before that, Bill Taylor from Scotland with his take on the same piece played on a 15th century Bray harp. Thank you. The Canyad of the White Piper, played there in two versions by Harper's Bill Taylor and Paul Dooley. I spoke to Paul Dooley a few days ago and asked him about his choice of instruments for these recordings. I wanted to know if the Robert ap Hugh manuscript itself has any instructions about what these pieces ought to be played on.
There are no specific instructions in the manuscript as to what type of harp or even what type of instruments the pieces were played on. I suppose what you really want to know is what type of strings were on the harp. The earliest evidence for that would be in Gerald of Wales' famous passage on instrumental music in Ireland, where, having listed the instruments of Ireland, Scotland and Wales, he adds that also they use strings of bronze and not of gut. And later on, he uses much of the same passage to describe the harp music in Wales. So certainly at the time, the harp in Wales would have had bronze strings or metal strings. So you need a harp with at least 25 strings from C below middle C to G 2.5 octaves above middle C to play all the pieces in the manuscript. But quite a number of pieces, and especially the longer pieces, the bigger pieces, some of them 20, 25 minutes long, only use 22 strings. So there's a hint that in earlier times, the harp might have even been smaller.
Paul Dooley. We heard earlier on from Sally Harper about the Cerdant tradition, but there were some very strict rules that were set down about this. Here's Paul Dooley again.
The tradition is that a meeting of Irish and Welsh master musicians was held at Glendalough in County Wicklow about the year 1100 under the auspices of the High King of Ireland. And one of the most important things we can tell from the Glendalough Council is that it's a Welsh tradition and it still had currency in the 17th century. According to the tradition, the official canon of 24 measures goes back to that time. But it's difficult to know what else would have been adopted back then. But the music in the manuscript certainly follows very, very strict rules regarding fingering, damping, harmony, rhythm and so on.
The Elegy for Ivan Abagov from the Robert Apphew manuscript, played by Paul Dooley. We've also been hearing recordings by Bill Taylor in today's programme, and he joins us now from a studio in Inverness. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks very much.
You play a very different harp. I want to know about the Bray harp. Tell me all.
Well, yes, for the most part, I use Bray harps to play the music from this manuscript. Really, from the Middle Ages until the present day, there have been a succession of different harps played in Wales. And for me, it's a matter of playing the most appropriate instrument to fit the time of the music. The earliest literary references to harps in Wales describe them having horsehair strings and sound boxes with a mare's skin stretched across, kind of like a drum. But by the late Middle Ages, the common harp that was played across Europe was the Bray harp, and that had long gut strings and was fitted with Bray pins. These are small wooden pegs that held the strings into the sound box, and they also lightly touched the strings and caused them to buzz. In English, we call them bray harps because they were thought to sound like braying donkeys. The sound, however, was especially loved in Wales, and the poems there describe the brays as having the ability to express every profound feeling. For me, the fascinating thing about this collection is that we get a clear picture of the techniques used in the day to achieve a decorative filigree, which I find a bit similar to the florid instrumental pieces that are played on the continent in the early 15th century, say from the Faenza Codex.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. So it's kind of more, there's more international bonding about the playing of the harp in the Middle Ages than I'd really imagined.
I'd like to think so. Also, considering that the Bray harp was the harp of the continent, it's also being played in England and Wales. This music is undoubtedly a bit odd and challenging for modern listeners. I think it removes some of that strangeness to be reminded that some of this stylistic music was going on elsewhere in Europe. Cagnard de Staffel, or the Cagnard or Song of the Chamber, is a true piece of medieval chamber music. The Staffel, or the chamber here, refers to the private apartment of the noble family, away from the great hall where the public festivities would have happened. Behind the scenes, away from the public eye, the Bardh Teili, or the poet laureate of the household, would quietly perform for the family. This is a gentle piece, rather melancholic to my ears, that seems to evoke a moment of restful quiet.
Thank you.
Harper Bill Taylor on a 16th century Bray harp playing that Canyad of the Chamber from the Robert ap Hugh manuscript. Sally Harper, thank you so much for being with me throughout the programme today. I'm not going to let you go just yet because we heard a setting of Psalm 150 earlier on with music from this Robert ap Hugh manuscript. And I want to close the programme with another vocal setting. This is a poem set to music. So how does it work, what we're going to hear? The music is presumably from the manuscript.
Yes, the music is from the manuscript, and we have a group of very short pieces within Robert ap Hugh's tablature, and this one bears the title Kainc, which basically just means a short melody, a sort of thing that was repeated over and over. What we don't know is how exactly words and music combined, but it does seem to make sense that we have this poem that survives by the poet with whom the kainc is associated, so to try to fit the two together with the kainc, the musical element itself being repeated as a kind of underpinning element, does seem to make sense in that respect.
Bragod, with that vocal setting of music from the Robert ap Hugh manuscript, the Kainc Rhyvedd ab Adda ab Dafydd. And that brings to an end today's early music show, which was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. Well, next weekend sees the beginning of Radio 3's broadcasts from the York Early Music Festival, and the Early Music Show will be featuring highlights from two concerts with a South American feel, Ensemble Villancico with Baroque music from Ecuador, and Florilegium with the next instalment of their Bolivian project and music of the Jesuits.
A partita and a sonata from Jennifer Pike and Nicola Benedetti. Christina Schaefer's celebrated Piero Lunaire. And Pierre Laurent Aimard joins a celebration of Debussy. The BBC Proms Chamber Music Series. Beginning with French song from Alice Coote. Monday Lunchtimes, live from London's Cadogan Hall at 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, it's time now for the Sunday Concert. It was recorded in London 2 weeks ago and it's presented again by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the historic Church of St Giles Cripplegate for this concert from the 2012 City of London Festival, given by the BBC Singers, organist Ian Farrington, and St James's Baroque, conducted by David Hill. This year's overall festival theme is Trading Places with the World, and the music we'll hear shortly explores one particular manifestation of that theme, London's position as a member of the great commercial partnership, economic alliance, and trading monopoly known as the Hanseatic League. The League flourished from the 13th to the 17th centuries, and at its zenith, it embraced cities from Russia through the Baltic and Scandinavian and German states. In this country, there were Hanseatic outposts in London, Norwich, Hull, King's Lynn, and Edinburgh. This concert will feature music by composers associated with some of the great cities of the League, names like Buxtehude, Telemann, and Bach, and there'll be a commemoration of the influential Dutch composer and organist Zweelinck, who died in 1612. Our first music is Bach's cantata BWV 131, probably his earliest to survive, written in 1707 while he was working in Mühlhausen, which had been part of the Hanseatic League since the year 1286. The cantata was composed at the request of Mr. Georg Christian Eilmar, Eilmar being Archdeacon of Mühlhausen, an ultra-Orthodox Lutheran and one of Bach's best friends in the city. It's a setting of words from the supplicatory Psalm 130, with verses from a Lutheran hymn. And in common with Bach's other early cantatas, it has a conventional and elegant symmetry of form, a sinfonia and chorus, followed by a duet for bass and soprano, another chorus, an alto and tenor duet, and a final choral fugue, whose text promises redemption. The solo singers are all members of the BBC Singers, stepping forward with their usual flair. Now the singers and St James's Baroque, led by Claire Salomon, are tuned and ready as we welcome David Hill to conduct them in Bach's cantata, Aus der Tiefen rufe dich Herr zu dir, out of the depths have I cried to thee, O Lord.